Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. We are into October, and that means that in a couple weeks, on October 11th, we'll have our Reading with Rogues. We're doing Harrow County this month,
yep.
And last month was Batman Long Halloween. We'll be talking about both of those, and talking about spooky comics in general.
Yeah, yeah. I would actually be interested to hear anybody tell the tales of, like, their favorite scary comics, or, because people are especially impressionable as kids, what terrified them as a kid.
Yeah.
It might be something that doesn't scare them at all now, or one of those, I accidentally got an EC comic and it was really messed up, or heavy metal, or whatever.
There's plenty of those EC comics that were messed up.
I had, you know, Epic Comics, their Epic Magazine, Marvel's Answer to Heavy Metal. There, my brother had a few issues of that. That messed me up a little bit. They were dark.
That's why you murder hobos now.
It's an outlet.
Sure.
So, yeah, I want to hear what other people's disturbing stories are so we can psychologically profile them.
Good plan. Gaming with Rogues, we're also doing sort of a horror event this month. That's going to be on Saturday, October 15th. The official game is Dead of Winter, but we'll also have Pandemic Reign of Cthulhu and some other sort of horror-y games. Would not surprise me if someone wants to play Betrayal House in Hell. And finally, Halloween Comic Fest, October 29th.
Yep.
That is Saturday, October 29th. We'll have free stuff not only from this year's selections, but from the last couple of years. So come and get some free comics, wear your costumes. We can take lots of pictures.
Yeah.
Halloween traditions, you guys. I know, Dave, you're big into the Septober thing.
Right, right. Well, yeah, and by that, that's just really, there's no specific ritual related to. It is only, it's a jump start on, for me, the kind of getting into scary stuff.
Yeah.
So, reading scary books or playing scary video games or watching scary movies and stuff like that.
And do you have any particular plans?
It only means for me that I've been focusing on, like, podcast Magnus Archives, which
sure.
Really liked. I've gotten several other people listening to that lately, and I will reiterate, people should check that out.
Yep.
I've played Mansions of Madness recently. Watching the new Exorcist TV show. I'll be catching more movies and stuff. I might do my 13 and 31 horror movie challenge.
Do you have any movies you're, like, wanting to see this year?
I don't know that there's anything, like, specifically in the queue. You know, it's always, like, a diverse variety. There's going to be some old favorites in there. There's going to be, you know, I know I want to catch a few new ones. My sister needs to see, my brother and I have been trying to show her what's the Cabin in the Woods for years.
Oh, wow, yeah.
She's a busy person, and so sometimes it takes a little while to get around to.
I saw The Witch is up on Amazon Prime. Is that one that you guys liked or hated? I can't remember.
Nick liked it, and I hated it.
Okay. All right. I always try to watch a couple of things. I'm not as big into Halloween as seemingly every one of my friends.
Yep.
But I do enjoy
it. Everyone who treats it like scary Christmas.
Oh, my God. It is Christmas for so many of my friends. And I like Halloween, but my friends love Halloween.
Yeah.
And
like, easy, people. Easy. Slow down, Maurice.
Whoa, Maurice. That's a Beauty and the Beast reference for those who don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. But look up Maurice Rave YouTube.
Yes. You'll enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
I'm also The Dead Set, the Charlie Brooker miniseries that is the British show that's a zombie invasion on the set of Big Brother, which is one of my favorite zombie shows.
Great. And I did actually watch the first 45-minute segment of that the other day with some friends I don't know if we'll catch the rest of it together or if they'll just catch it separately, but I was reminded of my love for that.
That just showed up on Netflix for the first time, and I probably will rewatch that. It's been a few years.
For those who've watched the great British TV show Black Mirror, same dude.
Also, Black Mirror has a third season coming to Netflix October 21st.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Super excited about that. Nick, what about you? Anything in particular you plan to catch?
I'm going to try to catch some more. I mean, we're always looking for horror movies, so we'll probably catch some that pop up on Netflix and Amazon. Nothing, like, in particular. I want to pick up The Conjuring 2 on Blu-ray, which just came out. I love that.
Is The Conjuring showing on Netflix or Amazon Prime? Is it streaming somewhere?
Not that I'm aware of.
Do I have your digital copy? I think I probably do. Maybe I'll watch that.
Have you not seen The Conjuring?
No.
The Conjuring is a very fun movie. It's, you know, it's James Wan again, so I feel like he makes the best popcorn kind of horror movies. They have a little bit more to them. They're not just popcorn.
I was going to say, they're not entirely
popcorn. But they're, you know, they offer a good mixture of character, you know, jump scares, eerie moments. You know, it's a little bit of everything, I feel like, but combined in a really good way. It's not, it doesn't feel like...
I know the Amityville Horror, I guess it was like early 2000s remake, just hit Netflix or Amazon Prime. And I can't remember if I've seen that. It has like a... Oh, crap. Deadpool. Ryan Reynolds as the father in it. And
I don't know if that bodes well.
If it had Deadpool as the father in it, that would be an interesting movie.
I feel like in a sort of serious movie like that, I'm not sure if it feels like his place to shine.
I think he can do serious.
What's he been serious in?
Green Lantern is very serious.
he's also got a movie called Voices, which I kind of want to see where his...
I've heard that was good, yeah.
Like his dog and cat start talking to him and trying to get him to kill people.
Yes, yeah.
Which sounds interesting and twisted.
But it's like a dark humor story, yeah. Which seems more up his alley.
You know what? There's a few horror video games I want to play that are... I never finished the... was it Until Dawn?
Yeah.
Which is a bit like a Telltale Games horror game, but with really polished production values and, like, actors cast as all the characters. The graphics were amazing on it. And it's sort of like a Cabin in the Woods type slasher thing with lots of different scary locales in it as you uncover the mystery of what's going on.
Okay.
You play all the different characters over the course of it. Definitely recommended for those with, I think it's, you know, basically current generation PS4 or... maybe Xbox One.
Yeah.
And I realized I never finished or I never got around to one of my favorite Halloween games. What is the name of it? Costume Quest, which is a good lighthearted. It's just super steeped in Halloween lore. It's like a kid's. It's like a like the Japanese RPGs of old, but with Halloween themes. And, you know, takes place on a trick-or-treat, you know, a Halloween night when kids are out trick-or-treating and monsters are loose in their town.
Sure.
Doesn't that have, like, a comic companion piece that did it from, like, the reverse, like, the monster?
Oni Press did a Costume Quest 2 graphic novel, like, right before Costume Quest 2 came out, they did that graphic novel, which you liked.
Right. It was really good. It was it was excellent and well-cartooned as well, too. They got, like, a web cartoonist guy who did a really good, does good video game-based web cartoons. And he really threw himself into it and did a great job. It felt very much in line with the game. But, like, I've never seen a game that's as Halloween-y as that is. Mm. If you trick-or-treated as a kid, it will bring back good memories of that.
I'm curious to see whether, like, the PS Plus free games of the month will be horror-themed or anything. Or if Overwatch does Halloween skins. That'd be awesome.
I don't think
they will. They did the Olympics, and that was a different thing. But if they did a limited-time, like, Halloween skins, I'd be super happy. Because that's the only thing. That's the only video game I have time for anymore is Overwatch.
They need to give somebody, like, a Jack Pumpkinhead.
Yeah. I feel like Roadhog could have a Pumpkinhead.
No. Junkrat.
Well, Junkrat already has the, like, Scarecrow version.
Yeah, he does. That's true.
It'd be funny if Roadhog had one that sort of went with it. It was like a jackal.
Maybe they need to give somebody a Pretty Princess variant.
That should be McCree. McCree should have the Pretty Princess variant.
Like a pony costume or something.
Yeah, yeah.
If they did that with a bit of tongue-in-cheek, they could have a lot of fun with it.
Blizzard does the tongue-in-cheek pretty well.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to the news. Not there's a lot this week, but one big thing is we just saw the premiere clip that EWCOM has of Superman and Supergirl together.
Right, from the season premiere of Supergirl.
Presumably the opening of the Supergirl season premiere.
Right, it feels like it could be the opening. I mean, for all I know, it's just a little ways into it, but probably the opening.
Yeah.
It's the ending. I'm going to put my money on it. That's how it's going to end.
All right, Nick, you're duly noted.
I can see it being in the middle as well. Who knows?
Yeah, right. I think, you know, what I've noticed is that everybody who's watched it online, you know, this made its way around on Facebook yesterday or the day before, everybody is like... Yep, that's Superman.
Yeah.
And this just reminds me of, like, you know, we can make all the excuses we want or for those who want to for, like, you know, oh, they got to change things in the movie. Oh, nobody would want, like, a Boy Scout Superman anymore. But you know what? When they deliver on it, people get all excited.
Yeah, but you know what, Dave? those people may not be the audience.
Maybe not.
I don't know.
For what? Like, for mainstream
it,
stuff
it
like
may
that?
Be, it may be that all the people we know love that Superman. But that
could be.
The great unwashed masses they're really, still, really like Superman who snaps necks.
Right.
super boots on necks forever. I don't believe that, by the way, for a second. I'm doing devil's advocate here.
Actually, you may not be wrong, though. I mean, you know, like, Supergirl does well, but it's not a mega blockbuster.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if it had a budget behind it and, you know, a top-notch team of writers, the same, you know, the same way Marvel's best movies have really pretty strong writing on them.
Yeah.
You know, I believe they could pull it off.
Well, one thing we can say for sure is if the grimdark DC universe in the movies is not your thing, Superman, the Supergirl will absolutely be your thing.
Yeah.
And it definitely is right at my wheelhouse. I was super happy. I know some people have been kind of worried about Superman sort of overshadowing Supergirl. And I will say in this clip, I think they did a good job with it. Like, he comes and asks if she needs help.
Right.
And then she's first on the scene and all that kind of stuff. But I do think that I would have preferred just a slight tweak. I wish that he had been the first one to get there and that he had been struggling with it and she showed up to help him.
Right, right.
I think that would have been a nicer message, but
I believe there will probably be some more nuance as the episode goes along. You know, one scene won't.
Do we know how many? I mean, how active he is?
We don't know.
Well, I don't think he's going to be active in the series. In the episode, he's going to be in and around, but I don't think he's probably going to show up a lot.
I would assume he's not going to be there a lot, but I don't know. He could be a semi-regular.
Actually, I guess I hadn't even considered the possibility
that if you're going to cast him, I thought
he was going to be in one or two episodes, maybe.
I don't know. If they cast him, I think it's probably a bigger deal.
Yeah, okay. I think he'll probably be in a couple of, more than that.
My guess was that they would bring in a big Superman villain, and that it'd be someone that required both of them to deal with.
Right.
But someone who's beaten Superman, maybe, that he needs help with.
Right. And they could also, if they wanted to, like, do, like, a, you know, Doomsday type storyline or something. They could even have a thing where he seems to be killed, and you know it amps the stakes for season three or whatever, because that's her going to be her bad guy in season three.
I also think his Clark Kent was fantastic.
Yeah,
straight up in the style of Christopher Reeve's version, which was the kind of stammering, nebbish kind of reporter.
He's having a conversation with Perry White on the phone, and they make reference to Great Caesar's Ghost.
Right. Well, he says, like, he's like, I'll have that on your desk, lickety-split, sir. And he's like, and you're hearing only his side of the conversation. Yeah. So he's like, yes, sir, I'm aware nobody says lickety-split anymore. But then he's like, he kind of needles Perry a little bit. He's like, I will point out that he's like, you do say Great Caesar's Ghost, and that's kind of a throwback.
Yeah.
And he's like, I know this isn't about you, sir.
But it's corny, but it feels like, I mean, Superman's corny. I mean,
and it's the same way Supergirl is.
That's what I was going to say. It feels like her relationship with Cat Grant.
Yes.
And you get that's the thing, is that he has the relationship with Perry that she has with Cat Grant.
I mean, I can make an argument that, you know, essentially the Supergirl series, part of why I like it so much is because I like Superman so much, and it is very modeled on Superman, making it a better version of Superman than I've seen in the movies, essentially since, I don't know, Superman 2 back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Nobody has been able to get it right. You know, they went from, like, the almost Nicolas Cage, you know, disaster to, you know, the overly reverential for the Bryan Singer version, to Grimdark Superman.
Speculation.
Yeah.
Would the Nicolas Cage Tim Burton Superman have been worse than the Zack Snyder Superman? Because I put forth that no, at least would have been interesting.
I agree. I think it would have been, like, kind of off the wall, kind of fascinating. You know, Batman 89 is still my favorite of the various Batman movies. And part of it, even though, you know, you can tell me it's like, oh, that Batman, he kills in this one, and he's not super effective, though. You know, he doesn't, like, do, you know, there are times when people get the drop on him, or crimes occur, and, you know, he doesn't really avert them well. Like, yeah, whatever, it was really fun to watch. You know, ridiculously quotable. It's a crazy, interesting, little, weird opus.
Yeah.
And also nostalgic, too.
It is crazy to me, by the way, that the best version of the DC Universe is on CW, the, like, fifth-run network.
Right.
But speaking of, I've been very nervous because I cut the cord, and then CW was like, yeah, we're not going to be on Hulu anymore, bye.
Yeah.
Well, they just announced they are doing a CW app. It's going to be on a variety of platforms, including Xbox One, iOS. So it'll be on my brand-new Apple TV, which is nice. And not only is it going to have everything, it's free.
Yeah.
Not like you don't need a cable login free. Actually free.
Yeah.
So anybody's going to be able to watch all these shows.
It's not going to be on PS4?
It's not going to be on PS4. Yeah. So you're going to need yourself an Apple TV, Nick. Sorry. or an iPhone or whatever. But
I'll watch it on my wife's iPad.
Yeah. But they're going to have everything. And because CW is one of my, honestly, maybe my favorite of the networks right now, I'm watching almost everything they do, not just the four superhero shows.
No, they're...
four superhero shows, by the way.
Yeah.
But
Randy, do you remember when we're iZombie?
Plus iZombie, plus Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Randy, do you remember when we were like, I hope this new show, Mantis, will be good.
Yep.
Like, that's all we got.
Oh, David, I mean, do you remember when we were so excited to have a Batman movie in theaters?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we live in a superhero golden age in pop culture right
true
now.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's great. CW app, I don't think it's available just yet, but it will be before October 20th when all the October 10th, I guess, when all the superhero shows premiere.
Right.
And slowly, I think Fox and CW are putting all their seasons on Netflix because... No, the second season of Gotham.
Hit. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Supergirl is on there. The second season of Flash is coming.
It hasn't hit yet, but it's soon. Yeah.
And I know the second season of iZombie is hit.
Yep. Out of curiosity, are they gonna, will they hit before the premieres?
Yeah. They tend to.
Yeah. And
I actually don't have a... I believe notably over half of the Flash season.
You got to about halfway through, yeah.
So my catch-up on that will not be too long.
Yeah, because Gotham hit before, because Gotham season 3 started, I think, last week.
Okay.
Well, we've been running, and amongst the other stuff that we run, we occasionally run Flash and Supergirl here in the store.
Yeah.
Right.
So
It's been fun. We've been running it in the last week or two, and watching that, I'm like, oh, yeah, Flash is awesome.
Yep.
You know, like that first scene where he's like, needs to run on water, and he's calling his backup team, asking him about, you know, what the tensile strength, what he needs, how fast he needs to run to not go through the water. And it's cool. It's like these really energetic, great, you know, superhero moments.
And it's just a reminder that Tom Cavanaugh is an awesome actor.
I just realized, by the way, that he's
he plays
the Harrison Wells.
Oh, yeah, he is great.
I just realized that all our news this week, aside for one story, are all TV superhero TV shows. So, The Tick from Amazon, which I can't remember. Did we talk about that?
We talked about the pilot. I hadn't seen it when we talked about it.
And I was not into it, but you liked it.
I really liked it. I did enjoy it.
And I'm very much a minority. Everybody seems to have enjoyed it, which is good because it's getting a full season order from Amazon.
Which I kind of expected, but
yeah,
it's
me
good
too
to hear.
Yeah. And then, we haven't seen this yet, but the Iron Fist show on Netflix has, I don't know if it's wrapped or the writing is wrapped or what.
I think it's coming close to wrapping.
Because, Tamara Becker, who's one of the writers on it, has just moved over to Hulu to work on their Runaways show.
Which is really cool.
Right, and just in case anybody thinking this is Joan Jett in the Runaways, this is Marvel's Runaways characters from their Brian Vaughn series maybe about 10 years ago?
I would assume our audience know who the Runaways wouldn't know Runaways over Joan Jett in the Runaways.
I was being a little facetious. But they might not know Runaways because it's also a generic term.
That's true.
This is a big reason why.
Because as a Marvel comic, it was a cult book.
It was.
And even though they've collected over the years and it's done well here because we always push it and it's Brian Vaughn.
Yep, there are still people who haven't heard of it.
Lots of people who haven't heard about it. We do still recommend it and everybody should check it out.
It's a big reason why I'm going to get Hulu. I'm looking forward to a Runaways television series.
Yep.
I would say that, if people have teens or even, you know, just a little younger than teens, Runaways is a great comic for them.
Well, and anyone who's liking Miss Marvel would love Runaways.
Yeah.
Not just because it's the same artist, but because it has that same vibe of in the Marvel Universe, but its own thing.
Yeah.
Finally, there's a comics-related announcement. There's a graphic novel coming from IDW and DC. It's going to be $9.99. It's coming out in December. It's called Love is Love. This is a tribute book that Mark Andreyko put together after the nightclub shooting in Orlando.
Oh, yeah.
All the proceeds are going to go to those affected by the nightclub shooting. And it's a 144-page comic. And Andreyko said, you know, he's a child of the 80s. He grew up with We Are the World and Live Aid. He began organizing this really quickly. And it's going to have more than 100 stories, each one or two pages. The creators include Damon Lindelof, Patton Oswalt, Phil Jimenez, and Olivia Coppier, and it is like it's going to be a who's who of who's in comics.
Right, right. They put together a pretty gold, A-list, gold star, yes.
Yeah, so it's for a good cause, and more to the point, it's also just going to be a great comic.
So it's going to be a comic, graphic novel?
Graphic novel, 100 pages.
100 pages.
So, I'm very much looking forward to that, and we'll be carrying that in December. All right, I think that's all the news we've got, so we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Comics for the Week. We were talking comics for the week of Wednesday, September 28th, and closing out September with a pretty strong week, I think.
Yeah. It was and a puffy week too.
Yeah. Oh man,
so much so that I feel like there's a lot I haven't looked at. I mean, I found some good books, but there's lots of stuff on the walls.
I have a few that I didn't get a chance to get to either. So,
kind of big stack I haven't gotten to.
Randy, I feel like you should start us off this time.
I will start us off. And I'm starting us off with a book called Castoffs, or The Castoffs.
One of the ones I want to read.
It is from Roar Comics, which is put out by Lion Forge Comics, which you may know as the people who are doing the Voltron book.
Okay. Yeah, that's a pretty good pedigree, because that's a good book.
They've also got the license to Care Bears and Madballs for the record.
Madballs?
Madballs.
Oh, man.
But this is an original property. It's by M.K. Reed and Brian Smitty Smith. M.K. Reed is someone who's worked at Marvel or Vertigo, I believe. I know the name. The artist is Molly Knox Osterlag. And it's definitely in that Lumberjanes, Goldie Vance kind of school as far as what it looks like, backstagers. It's very beautiful. It's very colorful. And the premise here is it's a world where wizards basically had this sort of world they lived in tune with nature, that kind of thing. Some men decided that they wanted a more technological society, created robots. Those robots became sentient and basically wiped out a lot of the world. So the mages and most humans live sort of on the fringes of this world that's been overrun by a robot apocalypse.
Huh. Now, it looks kind of all ages looking at it,
and
isn't
yet,
it?
And yet, yeah, it has more of an all ages
vibe.
Darker,
that's a dark theme.
It's a,
like
it's a dark setting, but it's basically just the terrors in the night kind of thing.
Right.
So this has three young mage girls. One of whom is sort of their best fighter. One of them is a scout who can turn intangible and pass through things, but who has a reputation for breaking things. And one of them is a healer who's kind of sassy and has a reputation for not one of their best healers, but has her own secret power, and that's why she's sent in this group. So the three of them are assembled to go run an errand sort of across the wilderness to another town two days away to take some potions and some other stuff. And it's sort of about how these three girls interact. And how one of the fighters sort of arrogant, and the one in the center, the one who's the scout is sort of a little mousy and unexperienced, and the one the other one who's sort of the potions master is kind of the I don't know, she's like the hip girl.
Okay.
And it's a lot about their interactions and about this sort of magic as an everyday use.
That sounds a little bit like, not Harry Potter-ish in the sense of, like, the school setting.
I can make the comparison.
But as far as, like, you know, magically trained younger characters, yeah, who are kind of, you know, they've all got their little quirks and weaknesses and strengths.
It's really, really good.
That art, as you're flipping through it, his art is really, it's for sure nice.
Okay, so the credits here are, Brian Smith is the writer of Stuff of Legends.
Oh, okay, yeah, and, which is a book that when I finally poked at it, I discovered I liked some of that.
And Molly Ostertag was the artist on Strong Female Protagonist, which I think was an Oni book.
Okay.
At any rate, it's a really fun book and was a real surprise from a publisher I'm starting to like want to keep an eye on. So definitely worth a look, especially if you've got young girls or anyone who's liked Lumberjanes or Goldie Vance or that kind of thing.
Yep.
Dave, what's your pick?
My pick is also, it is both Disney and put out through the smaller publisher of Joe Books Limited.
They have all the Disney stuff.
Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean. There's not been a lot of fanfare for this, but I've been looking forward to it since it first announced like 6 or 8 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is written by Chris Schweitzer, who, in addition to, he's been a guest at the store any number of times.
Mm-hmm.
He's an amazingly talented cartoonist. You know, I kind of, he does the Krogan books, and I'm trying to think what else he's done.
Well, online he's a ton of movie posters and that kind of
thing. Right, right. He's one of these artists who I somewhat liken in my mind with, like, Sergio Aragonés.
Yeah.
And his ability to draw both kind of dense and elaborate stuff and do it with real conviction and knowledge. He does not draw this, though, but the artist, Joe Flood, is they're kind of a single of a type, and it's a good type. So this is a Pirates of the Caribbean comic that you might think of as like Lost Adventures of Jack Sparrow and Friends.
Yeah.
Because I was happy to see like lots of other characters, not lots, but like
Gib, who's his like
his first, sort of first mate.
Yeah.
Yeah, is in there. Let's see, I guess, are those the only ones they mention, this actually takes place right after the first movie, because they mention the cursed crew of the Black Pearl, and that they're on the run from Commodore Norrington?
Yeah.
Well,
I see in here, she's not in it very much, she's mostly just visually in it, she has a couple lines, but The black woman who was the other pirate captain who became part of his crew.
Yeah.
And the younger, the dwarf who, I can't remember who played him, but he's one of these guys who've seen him in other stuff.
Right, right.
He doesn't even have any lines. He's just in here.
Right. So, yeah, they are, you know, it is, kind of has a cartoony look to it, and yet because the voices of the characters are down so much, like Sparrow himself and his friends and foes, it feels, like, really of a piece with the movies.
Yeah. By the way, is he... He's not actually... There's no like, dwarves and elves. He's a little person. He's not a...
Right, right. Yeah, it's... Although there's magic stuff commonly throughout yeah. these things.
I was like, wait a minute. That's not right. There's no, like, elves and stuff right. in this.
He's a little person in he's the a little person. Real world in the real world, it, and yes. not... He is not, like, a hobbit dwarf
yes.
fan. But anyway...
That was probably deeply offensive. I'm very sorry.
Hobbit dwarf
man. Look, that's what Randy was saying.
I'm just going to sit here.
I could have said Snow White and the Seven Dwarves.
That would have made more sense with the Disney connection.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, whatever.
Oh, man, they should do that. They should do a big Disney shared universe.
It's not the craziest idea.
Like, that in comics, I'd love to see that. Anyway, talk about pirates.
Yeah. You know, there's already, you know, they did that with Final Fantasy.
And Kingdom Hearts, but also,
with their TV show, Ever After, or whatever that is.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But I feel like, yeah, a comic would be a good place for something like yeah. that, a kind of shared universe.
Like an actual, the comic versions of them.
Right, right.
Yeah. Fables.
No, because that's too dark. Fables is more like Once Upon a Time, which is sure. the Disney shared universe. No, I'm talking more like something like this that's definitely deliberately all ages, where you like you have like the seven dwarves aren't the only dwarves in the world and that kind of thing.
Right.
Anyway, get on that, Dave.
I'll see about making that happen. But Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes.
As it happens right now, they are like stranded on an island, and they're what is it that Jack's after?
He's after a map. We don't know what map, but I'm guessing that map is going to tie into the rest of the story.
Right. It's the sort of central thing that he and his guys are after, and they're hacking their way through this jungle when it begins, and they come across this cove. I forget what they call it. It's got a
Windward
scary name.
Cove.
Windward Cove. Yeah, that's supposed to be protected by the dead.
Since they have, like, just days before run across a skeletal pirate crew, they're right. a little sketchy about this.
Yes. And I don't want to say too much about it, but there's some interesting twists and turns yeah. to it. And they run into, though, also in the jungle, they run into a band of, are they, like slaves in hiding, Randy?
That's what I was getting, yes.
Yeah, they're, like, escaped slaves, essentially, that are being hunted, and that occasionally themselves make raids and stuff like that. But I felt like, you know, the leader of them is this woman who, you know, and I know Chris Schweitzer knows his pirate stories yeah. and his history.
Yeah.
I have a feeling she probably draws influences from real world
characters.
She's
probably based on someone.
But also there's that kind of larger than life characterization that you get in the Pirates movies.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm talking when they're like at their best and not the kind of the sluggish moments in them, in all yeah. of them, to be honest.
Yeah.
She's a really notable character who ends up, you know, she's got a past with Jack Sparrow, just like every other roguish type character does. And they end up sort of working out a deal that, in the tradition of all Jack Sparrow deals, kind of goes south. And, you know, there's a question throughout of who he's playing. But there's also, you know, this is the Sparrow of the movies, who is a scoundrel, but with a heart of gold. So there's generally he's going to err on the side of being a good guy, but there's sometimes you're like maybe not here. I don't know.
Hey, Schweitzer nails the voice for Jack Sparrow.
Oh, he does. He does. He's got the great turn of phrase. Those yeah. sudden moments where he's like suddenly almost a little bit erudite, you yeah. know, in his way of speaking. And then he just falls into, like, kind of classic pirate stuff at times.
He likes to throw out savvy, yeah. which I remember as being yeah. a notable little bit.
Yep.
Yeah, and I don't just mean, like, his voice, like, it sounds like him. I mean, just, like, the way he acts and his – everything you loved about Jack Sparrow in the movies is here.
Right. He even has the – you know, there's even a little bit of that sort of, you know, visual humor and stuff, like the – I mean, this is a random example, but you know the bit where he like steps off the sinking ship at yes, the beginning of
yeah,
the first one?
Yeah.
They don't do anything quite like that, but there's those little visual bits of humor and stuff like that yeah. to really establish it as this is Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean. One thing I noticed about this is that it's Chris Schweitzer gives you a lot of, you know, bang for your buck as far as like it's kind of a dense story,
yeah.
but like not in that bad way. I felt like I was engaged throughout. But it's almost like in this one issue, which is just normal issue cost, in fact, just $2.99, I felt like you almost get like a little miniature graphic novel. Like a kid is going to have a lot to chew on with this. It'd be a great, you know, I would have loved this as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
And as it is, this is the kind of thing I'm thinking, yeah, I could easily buy the graphic novel for this when they collect this in, you know, several issues, I'm sure, together. But it is a great start. It's you know, lost adventures that feel like they could have been in the movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's not a lot of... are there any other pirate comics out right now?
Not that I can think of.
And this is like, you know, kind of the classic pirates that I kind of want to see, the adventuresome pirates. Mm-hmm. You know, so there is a real threat in it. Like, a few characters get killed in the mm-hmm. course of this issue. But it is still all ages and adventuresome, and yeah. not like, you know, they're going to slit his throat. You know, it's not quite that super grimdark of real piracy.
Although that said, why hasn't Vertigo or Image done a really good, like, gritty adult pirate series?
You know,
Cross-Gen
had a good one, and it was actually not super gritty, though. It was still adventuresome, but it was steeped in
El Cazador.
It's a great book.
Randy, do you remember the one that was written by, oh, he's one of those British invasion writers, not Peter Milligan. There was a really creepy one from Avatar, and it was super adult.
Oh, yeah, I'd forgot about that.
Yeah.
I don't think it ever finished.
I don't know. I do know that when I read it, I found it occasionally actually disturbing.
I think this is one of those things, like, maybe Azzarello is not just like, Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Rizzo could do a kick-ass pirate comic.
Yeah, you'd think that would be something
apparent. I feel like Brian Wood should do it if he's got a love for the
movies. Oh, man, Brian Wood could totally.
He should do a pirate
comic. Brian Wood could do a pirate comic. You know what's interesting? In your review of this book, which I liked, by the way, quite a bit, I've pitched two other books.
Yes.
Something about Schweitzer sort of fires up the imagination.
You know, I did see, you know, how he was doing rough sketches of, like, pirate ships and stuff like this to aid for his for the artist who works on the series, just as far as, like, he like, has a real sense of ships. I've even seen on his Facebook page, he actually sails on those, you know, what do they call them, tall ships or whatever.
Yeah, he does. Yep.
He actually does do that stuff, and he's had a lot of awareness of it. So he's like, this is exactly how the mast works and all that stuff. And I saw some drawings he had done showing the artist how that worked. I'm like, how cool must that be? This really feels like an inhabited world.
Yeah.
I want to watch the movie, the first movie.
I do, too.
Which I legitimately think is a great movie.
Oh, I have the first two on DVD, and actually,
I think with each subsequent one, you kind of go downhill.
It gets lesser, but even the fourth one has stuff to recommend it. It is like, for me,
I actually felt like the fourth one was a bit of a return to form.
Really? Interesting. Yeah. I haven't rewatched it. I feel like the Pirates movies for me are kind of like the Lethal Weapon movies.
Yeah.
The first one's legit good.
Right.
I mean, the first Pirates is not as good as the first Lethal Weapon.
But it's quite good.
And then the later ones, even the ones I don't like as much, I can still enjoy watching.
Y'all remember... Go ahead,
who
Nick.
Was the director? Is it McTiernan? Not McTiernan.
Gore Verbinski.
Gore Verbinski, yeah. That's right.
But he didn't do all of them.
No.
Yeah, I think he kind of bit off a little more than he was ready for as far as epicness.
Yeah.
Y'all know that because I remember talking about it for this very podcast. Like a year or two back, I watched all of the Pirates movies like back to back.
Yeah,
but I did it like I would like watch an hour a night, and so it essentially I got it as like as if it was serialized TV.
Yeah,
and there it actually worked really well. It didn't get too bloated with the long action sequences. I was like, oh, I'm just going to tune in for another tonight's adventures of Jack Sparrow. And, you know, over the course of like 8 nights or whatever, you know, you watch all of them.
But you get Jeffrey Rush's Barbossa.
Barbossa is the hidden star of those movies.
Yeah,
he's amazing. He's amazing in it. And, you know, there's lots of other fun characters. I actually like everybody, even the slightly bland heroes.
Yeah. Nick, what's your pick?
I am going to talk about, for a moment, the Teen Titans Rebirth issue.
People have been waiting on this one.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think you and I were talking earlier and just saying how Teen Titans is kind of... DC could do more with this title.
It is one of the most untapped books, given the fierce love that people have, especially for the cartoon of the mid-2000s?
Yeah.
Was it? You know, so the same way that, like, the X-Men cartoon of the 90s was such a big thing.
Yeah, it's beloved.
But it generally represented the comics, and so there were comics that were very close to that. But there have not been comics that are actually very close to sort of the tone and characterizations that
other than Teen Titans Go.
But those are sort of licensed books.
Yeah.
We're talking about, like, the influence where the show influences the actual mainstream
book. Right. And so, but yeah, in general, I felt like they're leaving money on the table.
Yeah.
So I haven't read all this, Nick. What would you say? Do they, do you feel like it's going to offer people what they want in a Teen Titans book?
Yes, I think it will, mainly
obviously it did for you.
No, I think it will, mainly because it does feature all the main characters.
Let's do the cast list.
Well, I mean, this is sort of a getting the band back together, a variant of getting the band back together.
I like those kind of stories.
That's what Rebirth issue should be. I think is the here's our pitch.
And it's kind of cool because each character gets their moment.
Yep,
you get to see where they are in life, what they're doing. I mean, like Beast Boy is kind of trying to live it up, live it off his sort of stardom and kind of his movie stuff that. I guess he's involved with. Didn't know that he was that, but
That sounds like a slight tweak to the character that he's like might be. Is he like sort of like a pop star flash in the pan? You know, hot young star.
He's got a Kato Kaelin kind of thing going.
I was like Freddie Prinze Jr.
Yeah. Right, like a guy who might be hot for like 3 months and then kind of fade.
Yeah. Then there's Starfire, who is still in Florida.
Keying off of the Starfire ongoing series that they had for a little bit.
And then Raven is sort of disillusioned because of her craziness with Trigon and, you know, dealing with all of that.
But is this traditional angsty Raven?
A little bit, yeah. It is. It feels more traditional Raven than we've gotten in quite some time.
Yeah.
And then there's Wally West, sort of, who I thought was interesting. The backstory they give for him is kind of, he's not as fast as the Flash, not as, he's kind of in the middle of everything in his life. He wants to be an adult, but he's not.
Wants to be the fastest man alive, but he's not quite there.
Yeah, and I thought there was some interesting stuff with him.
Justice League kind of stole Cyborg, and I think Wally West they're slotting in as the replacement character for that role. But he's not the tech guy that Cyborg is.
No,
but,
he's not.
But they wanted that. And Wally West goes back with the Teen Titans. It makes a certain amount of sense.
Yeah, and then, you know, it's just kind of fun. That is kind of they're grouping up to take on a bigger villain, and I think it was a fun issue.
There's some attacks.
There are some attacks. There's some twists, which I will not reveal. And I think I want to talk about the art. The art is very, very nice.
Oh, man, yeah, it's really nice.
It has sort of animated style, animated series style to it.
It reminds me a little bit of, like, Young Justice or something like that.
Who's the artist?
It's John Boy.
Okay, because it reminds me of
John Boy.
John Boy is his name. John Boy Myers.
Yeah, John Boy Myers.
Do you remember that Teen Titans Year One they're about to put back in print? That had that gorgeous.
Carl Kershaw.
Yeah, I think it has a little bit of that vibe to it.
That's
it's
sort
really
of like
beautiful.
Almost like cell animated.
Yeah,
look, but it's like the colors are really rich.
Yeah, it's totally
very rich.
Yeah,
here.
It's really beautiful looking. The Starfire segment was my favorite. I thought they've really. New 52, they really, really hurt that character, and they finally sort of dragged her back to being what people want her to be.
And I actually thought that Beast Boy was my favorite, because it's a different spin on the character than I've seen before. And his scene is all about sort of trying to woo a lady, essentially, and how he's not great at it, and he's sort of turning into beasts to sort of impress her, and all he's screwing it up.
Weirdly, that does fit the basics of the old New Teen Titans one. He was kind of always chasing after girls and, like, coiling around. There was a slightly, in those days, stalkerish vibe or, like, creeper.
Well,
vibe.
They captured that.
Oh, did they?
I found it a little off-putting, to be honest.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I thought it was a little aggressive. I had issues. It's one of those things where, like, I think any woman would have left long before he got to that point.
And I like that in the bigger part of the DC universe, it is still dealing with the fallout of Detective Comics.
Yeah.
That had to do with the team and and the friendships that they had.
Right.
Which is really cool that something is
happening.
Talking
about some of the big
effects.
Developments that happened in recent Detective
It feels
issues.
Like it's a more cohesive DC universe than we've had in New 52. Which
immediately
felt kind
after
scattered.
Something notable occurred in it, like within less than a month,
it's
kind of acknowledged in other books, yeah.
And then there's the big twist at the end. And I think it's a fun thing, and you get to see why they're being brought together.
We're
as
not
a team.
Actually teens; we're all 20.
I have a love for Teen Titans, so I'm glad that the book is back, and I will say I have a love for the Geoff Johns era of Teen Titans.
That's kind of where you came in. That was your entry, right?
And that was Wally
early
West,
2000s.
And, you know, them fighting Deathstroke and first out, and it was a fun series.
Nick,
Okay, backup pick. We'll go in reverse order. No, I picked the other Rebirth issue this week, and that is Batman Beyond. Now, I think all of us at this table have a fondness for Batman Beyond. Dave, I don't know.
I do, but I have the least fondness of them all, because I don't think I watched every episode of that.
Were you one of the people who was kind of mad when they did it?
No.
Okay. Because I remember there was a bunch of fans that were very... They were like, this took our Batman animated series away from us. And so
they were like, it turned him into a punk kid.
Turned him into a punk kid. And there was definitely, like, there was a rumor that, like, WB had said we want to go younger with it, and that Batman anime was appealing too much to the older crowd. And then Batman Beyond came on, and it was great.
Yeah, I think I wasn't super interested in it, but, like, when I did watch it and stuff, it was... brilliantly done, as good as anything that they were doing on Batman the Animated Series.
In a lot of ways, at its best, it's Batman by way of Spider-Man.
Right.
It is. Who showrunned
I have no idea who was on, if it was anybody. I'm pretty sure Dini and Tim were still involved, but I don't really know.
But now, the big question is, who is Batman Beyond in this?
Well, and they take care of that, and it's Terry McGinnis. Line one is, my name is Terry McGinnis. So they're getting rid of...
and I've just been shot.
Future Quest? Or no, not Future Quest, but what was their... Future's End. So that was the
where Tim Drake
became...
Had become Batman Beyond.
Yes, and they're getting rid of that. Yeah.
Well, that might have been an interesting story to do. People want Terry McGinnis in the role. Yes. And that's good.
This is definitely him coming back to the costume, back in the future... dealing with sort of a rise of the Joker's gang, and sort of seeing them do things that they haven't normally done. They're kind of upping their game, wanting money and things like that, which where they're normally just after chaos.
Right.
So it's interesting to see. I was really excited because I'd completely forgotten who was doing the art in this, and it's Ryan Sook, who I fell in love with when he was doing X Factor.
You fell in love with his art, or did you fall in love with him?
Both.
No, he's a nice man.
How could you fail to have fallen in love with this guy?
His art is beautiful. I mean, it's just fantastic.
He is amazing.
And he does great action sequences where he does in this, where you see Terry take on a kind of gang of Jokers. And he's got sort of the J.H. Williams when he's doing sort of like panel layouts and things like that. And he gets to use fun sound effects. And it gives you a rundown of all of sort of the history of Batman Beyond, kind of the origin story of Terry and how he sort of met Bruce and
Recap in case you are either blurry on the details or perhaps some people who have never, you know, seen the cartoon, perhaps.
Yeah, and then, of course, dealing with his girlfriend, Dana, and Barbara Gordon as the police chief, commissioner of Gotham, or Neo-Gotham, as they call it.
Yep,
well.
Yes. I thought it was effective. It kind of got me jonesed to go back to watching the series a little bit.
Is the tone pretty close to the series?
I think so.
It's not, like, notably lighter or notably darker?
No, I didn't find it actually dark at all. It felt very in line with what we've seen before.
That's good.
And it has me... The end, of course, there's a big twist, and it has me curious as to what is going on. So, yeah. Dave, what is your pick?
Secondary pick, I'm all licensed franchisey stuff this week. My secondary pick is a book that I was hoping would be good and proved to be good, Star Trek Waypoint. Just a few months ago, they wrapped up a month or two back, the previous Star Trek comic that they were putting out, based on the Abramsverse, the Kelvinverse.
Although there is a new one that's coming out that's based on that, too.
But now, thankfully, it's accompanied by one that's a callback to the long-standing prime Star Trek universe, all the TV shows that people have watched over the years. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's kind of a celebration of all of them because... I don't know if it's always going to be this format, but there's two stories in this.
I think it is. I think it's going to be sort of an anthology series.
Yeah, it feels like, I don't know, I didn't get a page count, but maybe it's a little more than 22 pages to accommodate
it does seem like it could
both
be.
Stories, because the first one is actually pretty decently long, and then the last one is kind of more of an interesting mood piece and character piece study. You know, and each issue, like, you could get a story from Deep Space Nine, right, classic Star Trek, Next Generation, Voyager. They're going to mix it up. And that means you're also going to get a variety of writers and artists. And that should be pretty cool to see a lot of different interpretations.
Yeah.
And right out of the gate, there's a Next Generation story and a original series story. And Randy, you were correct when you mentioned to me that the vibe was very notably, Star Trek.
Yeah.
In the sense that this first one is built around kind of a solving a mystery and a technological puzzle.
Yeah, it's an alien encounter, and there's a mystery, and it's communication and figuring things out. And it's not about blasting away the Klingons or whatever else.
Right, or vengeance on somebody, or running through hallways with J.J. Abrams guys do a lot of running
It's very much, it's the thinking Star Trek, which I think you and I have both been desperately missing.
Yeah. And it begins with an interesting thing that we were trying to figure out if it's sort of set, I think it is, in the future of Star Trek, which is to say, even past the era, past, like, I think Star Trek Nemesis was the last official sort of major release.
Yeah.
And it feels like it could be 10 years after that or something.
I feel like this is Geordi about the age of Picard when Picard was running the ship.
Right. So, in fact, Geordi is the captain of the ship here. You know, they don't say the name of his ship, do they?
It's the Enterprise.
Is it the Enterprise?
They do say the Enterprise.
Oh, okay. And his bridge crew is multiple incarnations of Data.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Sounds scary.
They do say that that the rest of... There is, like, a crew on the ship.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, now he specifically mentions that he... He says, we still carry a full complement of staff elsewhere aboard the Enterprise, of course, but truth be told, if he wanted it, Data could run this ship himself.
Mm.
So like, it's primarily this story is set between, you know, the two guys who had been best buddies, you know, Geordi and Data, mm-hmm. or in this case, multiple Datas. You know, what's interesting is Data does have, I forget if he, you know, the he's got some emotional qualities mm-hmm. to him. But they found a good medium, because a lot of times when Data gets emotions, that's kind of a big thing. But I always kind of miss the Data that's honestly more Spock-like, you know, the kind of the classic series version. And I thought this was one of the first times I've seen a really, I think, good medium, where he was a little more colloquial, still Data for sure.
He can make jokes, but he's still Data.
Right. Yeah. And without getting too much into the storyline, they encounter the sudden presence of this... of another ship that's in, like, it's sort of like in this giant sort of energy cube sort of thing that is clearly from the future.
Yeah.
And they, the initial quandary is that they're trying to interact with it. There seems like there might be an emergency on board that they want to help with. Only the ship is saying that it won't allow them to help because of the Prime Directive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, what is your weird future Prime Directive? Yeah. What's going on here? And it's about them trying to figure that out. So you'll get, it is very much like a classic Next Generation episode in its exploration of, you know, how to get through this concept. And it has a kind of neat ending too. The second story, I also really liked, and I have to say has the most beautiful art. I really like
the writer and artist is the same person, and she's a creator. I don't know. By the way, that first story is written by Donnie Cates.
Yeah. Who's that?
Who's an Austin guy.
Oh, very cool.
He did that Interceptor series that we liked. That was about the vampire from space thing. And he's done a few other things from Dark Horse. Yeah. And this is a really good outing for him.
Good job, Donnie Cates. Yeah, the second one is interesting. It's an Uhura story.
Yeah,
and by the way, I'm just going to jump right out and say the art is beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
It's there was something we were looking at. Well, you're just talking about the sort of lushness of the Teen Titans thing. This is lush in a different way, but it has some of that because the alien planet is drawn in this really nice, exotic, colorful way. And it has a slightly painted look to it. It reminds me of Phil Noto, maybe a little bit.
I was going to say, I could also see a little bit of that Frank Cho stuff when he's on his game.
Yep.
And I feel like there's definitely a person to compare it to that I can't. I mean, maybe a little Josh Middleton?
Yeah, I could see all of those.
None of those are 100% right, but they'll give you some idea what we're talking about.
Well, what happens is that there's been some sort of transporter accident that's like scattered the crew on this alien planet. And essentially, while they're... you know, kind of in lockdown mode waiting for the repairs to happen, Uhura encounters this alien that she's trying to learn to communicate with, which is obviously right up her alley.
Yeah.
And what follows is kind of partially... it's not all visual, but it is almost like it's a moment-to-moment sequence of her trying to sort of figure this alien out. And by the way, very cool-looking alien.
Yeah, it's just like it's a little thought piece. It's a little
right.
It's a day in a few minutes in the life of Uhura, and they give her a character that I don't think she ever fully got until later in the series. There's a little bit of more character to her here.
Right, and you know she had moments in the series, but back in the show, you know, you had the three primary characters, and Scotty and Chekhov and those guys. They had, you know, they had quick go-to personalities, but they didn't have a lot to them.
Right,
and so it's nice to see her get a little bit more time. And again, you know, this actually has an ending that I quite liked, and an interesting sort of a little bit of a melancholy tone at times in it. So I'm gonna give a thumbs up to Star Trek Waypoint and say all the Trekkie fans, especially old school Trek fans who maybe haven't been catered to by the stuff in the Kelvin universe, or just anybody who's got some any Trek fondness should give this a look.
All you Trekkies and TV addicts, don't mean to front, don't mean to bring static.
Yeah, let's see what's the next
all
line,
you Klingons
Randy?
And the mother, and my pick. My pick is Spider-Woman number 11, which I know I've picked a lot of this book. It is probably my favorite book.
We're sick to death of you picking it, Randy.
You may have picked all 11 issues.
I might have. Anyway, this is Dennis Hopeless's Spider-Woman book, and the notable thing for me here is that Javier Rodriguez is no longer the artist. He's moving on to do something else, the Doctor Strange spinoff, I think. So they're bringing a replacement, Archie's Veronica Fish. The last time Veronica Fish took over, it was on Archie, and it was from Fiona Staples, and I was not crazy about it. Even though I could see her art was good.
Yeah. It felt like a letdown to you.
The bar it was set was too high, and it was too much of a jarring change, and I didn't like it. I was really scared that was going to happen here, because I loved Javier Rodriguez's art. But instead, Veronica Fish really comes through. This is a great-looking book still, and I love her take on all the characters. I love her take on Porcupine. I love her take on
Jessica
Drew.
Wildly different from
from
the previous art.
It's of a piece.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I love when a series kind of establish as a general look. You know, way back when Brubaker was doing Captain America, he would have Butch Geist or Steve Depting and stuff like that. But they all, or even Michael Lark, they shared a certain visual similarity, and I appreciate when they do that.
But the Civil War II story, which I know some people are not liking, some people are, the thing I like about it is that it's giving some of these characters ways to interact. It gives some of the writers a chance to have these characters interact. So Spider-Woman is an ex... Hawkeye's one of her ex-boyfriends.
Yep.
And they sort of reveal in here that she was friendly, not just with Banner, but with the Hulk. Like, she got along with the Hulk. And so she's having to deal with the fact that one of her friends murdered another of her friends and what's going on. And her best friend, Carol, is the one responsible for all of it.
Right. So it stands to reason that Spider-Woman would be particularly... maybe devastated or confused by everything.
She's angry, she's conflicted, and she wants to talk to Hawkeye, but Carol's not going to let her do that, so she basically decides she's going to break in and go talk to him anyway, which puts her at odds with Carol. It's a really good emotional story, and it does what Spider-Woman's been doing, which is a perfect blend of sort of emotion and superheroes, action and character, and it's just fantastic stuff. So everyone should be reading this book, and not enough of you are. So get on that.
Randy scolded him.
Yeah. Also on my list this week, the Doctor Strange Annual, which sees the return of Doctor Strange's estranged extra-dimensional wife, Clea.
Estranged.
Miss Marvel number 11, which continues to be one of the best takes on a Civil War II tie-in, has some real ramifications, not just for the Miss Marvel-Captain Marvel relationship, but for Miss Marvel's relationship with her friends. For those who say crossovers never change anything, definitely G. Willow Wilson took this as a challenge and have had things change in her books. Captain Marvel number 9, which sees Ruth Fletcher Gage and Christos Gage writing Carol and Alpha Flight, and they sort of interact with Magneto when he wants to know why they're spying on him, and it's all about sort of the breakdown of what's going on with Civil War and if Carol's in the right or not, and her friends are starting to sort of wonder about her.
I have to say, every time I peek in on like how it's affecting other stories, I have to say these don't sound like throwaway things like, oh, there's a Civil War fight that's just going on in the background in the issue. It actually always sounds like they find a way to engage with the main character and throw something uniquely their way.
And I think that's what a thing is. Even if Civil War II, the Ultimate Series, doesn't wind up panning out for me, and I suspect it won't. It's Bendis, and he's never landed an ending once for me. the after effects on the Marvel Universe have been really interesting to me. Nighthawk, the penultimate issue. I just love this book, and I'm looking forward to the finale and having a nice trade on my shelf. Civil War Kingpin number 3 is weirdly dark and sees Punisher facing off with Kingpin. Steve Rogers' Captain America number 5 is more revelations of exactly... They're 5 issues in, and they still haven't quite revealed Cap and Hydra. They're still doing the sort of the backstory of how he got to that point.
Uh-huh.
But they're not doing just a bwahaha evil Cap here. It's definitely a more subtle than that. And I'm curious to see where they go with it.
It is not simply Cap the Hydra agent.
No, there's definitely... He's the thing. This is not someone...
within wheels.
Yeah, not someone transverse his brain. This is Steve Rogers. What if the Steve Rogers we know, the strategist, the dedicated soldier and all that, was in service to Hydra instead of America, what would that look like? And it's an interesting look. A little frightening for Captain America to be a bad guy, actually.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I would imagine he's, like, wildly effective, generally, yeah, as a leader, so...
Yeah. Star Wars number 23 continues the story of the rebels infiltrating the Imperials. Captain Kidd number 2, which is the kid who can turn into a superhero, that's coming from Aftershock Publications from Mark Waid and Tom Pyre. Generation Zero number 2, which we all really liked last week. There's more conspiracy superheroes in the Valiant Universe. Lake of Fire number 2, which has more knights versus aliens, which I really liked. This definitely has the aliens sort of encroaching on their camp. It's more of a assault on Precinct 13 kind of thing. And Snot Girl number 3 continues the story of vapid fashion bloggers, for those who like that kind of thing. Dave, what else you got?
The first thing on my pile is actually something I haven't read, but you have, and said it was pretty good. It was a graphic novel with the unlikely name of Baggy Wrinkles.
Yeah.
A Lubber's Guide to Life at Sea. Now, this looks to me like it's kind of an all-ages graphic novel.
It's autobiographical.
Really?
It is a story of a girl, the cartoonist, whose name, yeah, I've blanked on. It's,
Lucy Bellwood?
Lucy Bellwood, who I believe is in the Portland Collective that is also have Steve Lieber and Colleen Coover and all those guys.
A lot of really good people.
I forget what it used to be, Periscope, and I believe it's a different name now. But she comes from that studio. She went out to sea, like to sail on an old tall ship,
mm-hmm,
and this is her recounting of learning to sail at sea.
That's actually really cool sounding. I think that sounds like a nicely focused biographical sketch.
It's really good and it's really interesting. You know, it's in that vein of Chris Schweitzer stuff.
Right, right. Let's see. There is this week, I haven't read this yet. There's all the books I'm mentioning are books I haven't read. Frostbite number 1 from Vertigo, which looks like it's kind of got a Day After Tomorrow, what was
Snow
that?
Piercer.
Snowpiercer kind of icy apocalyptic future storyline, yeah, going on.
This one's written by Joshua Williamson, the guy who wrote Flash and
Birthright.
And I thought it was actually a pretty good first issue. It's okay. Dark and sort of a little depressing about just how bad the post-apocalyptic world
is. It
is
post-apocalyptic.
In this ice age that has come, but there's some interesting ideas in there, and I'm curious to see.
And lastly on my list of things of note that I also haven't read, first issue of the Josie and the Pussycats relaunch.
Yeah.
Right alongside, you got Archie, Jughead, Betty and Veronica, yep, and now Josie and the Pussycats. Marguerite Bennett writes, who's notably been, she's been doing DC's Bombshells series,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Among other things. That definitely had her on my radar, so I'm looking forward to checking that one out.
Nick, what else you got?
So I have Detective Comics 941, which is the third part of Night of the Monster Men.
Is it third and final, or is there...
No, there's more, two. Okay. I think there's two of each.
Oh, there's two of each, okay.
Yes. Then, from my childhood, Revolution Mask, or the acronym Mobile Armored Strike Command.
That's the Revolution series that IDW has been doing,
yeah, which is
featuring...
G.I. Joe, Transformers, ROM,
and
Micronauts.
Mask.
And Mask. And this is actually kind of a weird change-up for the Mask, because they're not versus Miles Mayhem. Miles Mayhem is actually the creator of Mask. So it's him forming a team that sort of is
going to work. Wait, is Miles Mayhem the Cobra Commander of Mask?
Yes, he's basically the ultimate villain of Mask.
But
so
this,
so they're going to reveal that he created Mask for nefarious purposes, and then,
yes,
they got to rebel against him.
Yes, more than likely that is where it's going. But there's some interesting ideas, and sort of it's fun to see some of the characters that I liked as a kid come back in new ways. So
I'm just saying, if your name is Miles Mayhem, you can't be a good guy.
That's very true. Then I've got the first issue of Blue Beetle, which was interesting. The first issue of Tarzan on the Planet of the Apes by Tim Seeley and David Walker,
mm-hmm,
which was a lot of fun, actually.
It's very weird.
It is weird, but after watching the Tarzan movie of the more recent one, mm-hmm, you kind of learn. I learned a little bit more about Tarzan,
uh-huh,
so it makes sense. They're actually using in continuity stuff from Planet of the Apes. So I was impressed with sort of the knowledge behind it.
Looking at this, by the way, that looks like the Planet of the Apes of the old school and not necessarily the new ones, although I know they do share characters.
Yes. But basically Dr. Cornelius and what's his...
Zira
travel back in time to...
Yep.
To
Tarzan Times?
Tarzan Times.
Okay.
So,
because, you know, in the original movies, they travel back in time to then-present day, like, 1970.
Right.
So this is just a slightly farther back for us.
Yes. new Image book, Surgeon X. This is the one helmed by Karen Berger, written by Sarah Kinney, which sort of...
Karen Berger is editor.
Editor, yeah. Right. And basically this tells of sort of a post-apocalyptic world where antibiotics have...
Antibiotic-resistant bacteria have become a thing. And
yeah,
it's,
and basically caused everything to go into collapse in a lot of ways. And one person who's this Surgeon X, who's kind of like this, not superhero, but...
Sort of a street doctor who's street trying doctor. To apply guerrilla medicine to fix the problems.
What was that manga? Was it called Blackjack?
Yeah,
the old, from Tezuka, the Astro Boy creator. He was like an outlaw surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The second issue of Hellblazer, which sees him and John and Swamp Thing sort of team up, it continues to be a lot of fun. Third issue of Suicide Squad. Third issue of Batgirl. You can see a theme with mine. A lot of DC books.
A lot of third issues.
Third issue of Deathstroke, which actually brings in Ravager, which I thought was a lot of fun.
The 964th issue,
yes,
I see, of Action Comics.
Of Action Comics, which is the second part of the Superman Meet Clark Kent story.
Yep.
And then...
Oh, I just have to quick ask, because I doubt that if they would do it so quick in that story. Do we know yet the deal with this... A mysterious Clark Kent who's
not
running around?
Yet.
Okay, just curious.
And then I have one more, and I saved the best for last. No, I'm joking. Deadpool Annual Number 1. There is actually something in here that I think will surprise both of you. Adam Warren does a story, and he actually brings back the Live Wires. So Gothic,
oh, wow.
So Gothic Lolita is in here. It is actually a lot of fun. But
I see that Spider-Man...
She's back.
I also see that Spider-Man and his amazing friends, that is to say the 80s cartoon incarnation of Spider-Man with Iceman and Firestar, are also in this issue.
Yes, they are indeed in this issue. But I thought it was a lot
of
fun.
Is Ms. Lion in it?
Actually, I don't know if... I'm sure she was at some point.
We can only pray.
I just thought it was
if
a
Deadpool
lot of fun.
If Deadpool doesn't, actually, you know, kick her into a street sweeper or something, I feel like he won't have done his job.
I'm sure it probably happens at some point. But yeah, I was actually really surprised to see the Live Wires, because that was a concept that
for people
Marvel
who didn't read that, that is a way deep cut from like what 10 years ago or so.
Oh, yeah,
Adam Warren, best known these days for Empowered, did a series about some basically humanoid androids in the Marvel universe. But it was a real cult book and kind of very very Adam Warren.
I loved that book. I would have loved to have
like
more of them.
They were
Shield.
Like Life Model Decoy variants?
LMD variants, like super advanced, going up against like AIM advanced technology.
Yeah.
They each had definitely very distinct identities. Yep. You know, they were not just like, we are, you know, six robot clone types.
No.
They were all really different powers.
And in the sort of same way, they had their kind of slang that they used, kind of very Adam Warren-ish.
Right. Yeah, his you know sort of cyberpunk knowledge also came to bear. So yes, if you get a chance, read that old series, and if you are one of the three fans of that series from back in the day, you might want to check out this Deadpool Annual, apparently. Or if you're a Spider-Man and his amazing friends.
Or if you like Deadpool, the less popular character of all three of those.
I guess.
Yeah. All right, that wraps up our comics talk for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about more fall TV. All right, we were talking fall TV. There's been a few more shows since last we talked, and several of them are on Fox, and one of them I have not seen, but you guys both have, and that is The Exorcist.
Yeah, this is definitely keying off of the... What year did the original Exorcist?
73, if I'm not mistaken.
Basically keying off of that.
But just as sort of like an impetus to it. Like, it's not... It is not like the events aren't specifically mentioned.
No.
I believe they're kind of like you might see them in a file somewhere, and there's a little visual reference and nod here and there.
But it's definitely a new case.
Right. And by the way, just real quick out of the gate, I was not looking forward to this show. I had no particular interest in it, to be honest.
I saw the trailer and I thought it looked just okay. I didn't think they would get it right.
Well, before we get too far into it, they did get it right.
They did.
So that's the good news. It does follow echoes the original movie in the sense that it's about a mom played by Gina Davis.
Yes.
Good get for this. and her troubled daughter. The family dynamics are a little bit different from this from The Exorcist because she's actually got two daughters, and one of them is specifically the source of the trouble.
And they also have her husband,
right?
Which is Cameron from Ferris Bueller. That's right.
Who's he's like experiencing almost like premature Alzheimer's.
Yes.
And there's some great scenes with him in it. He's some.
Well,
some...
he's fantastic. Why am I blanking on his name, Randy? Cameron from.
Man,
but he had some moments in Justified, and
he's good. But I don't remember his name either.
He is. The other dynamic in it is there is a priest we're introduced to separately early on. He's obviously going to end up involved with it. He is before even the episode is out.
You're talking about the young priest?
The young priest, yeah.
I really liked him. I thought his story was interesting. He's kind of like this new priest who's new to bringing in sort of a larger crowd to the church.
Yep. He has a certain, like, unconventional style and is, like, kind of...
He's more down-to-earth.
I'm going to say, yeah, he's kind of youthful and down-to-earth, which sounds like it's, like, kind of the cliché that, like, every church is kind of trying for that these days. But he's sort of also very genuine, and he's immediately likable.
He's immediately likable, but we also know that he's got sort of, like, a past with him, too, because is it his sister that he's watching? His like, niece?
Yes.
No, it's his nephew.
Right.
And he's watching his nephew, and I know his... sister mentioned something about don't do what you've done before.
Yep.
So,
you know, this first episode actually gives you a lot of information, and it comes together really nicely in the end.
And it's beautifully shot.
Yep.
Just some of the cinematography is
creepy.
It's creepy.
Early on, this priest, he begins to experience these dreams in which he's visualizes, is it in Mexico?
Yep.
Or like Mexico City, I think. Where an exorcism is taking place in sort of almost a slum section, and it's as if he's in the room where it's taking place, and he can see what's going on, but they can't see him.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of, you know, you're not like, is this really happening? Is this a dream? Is it a prophecy? Or, you know, you're not quite sure. But of course, these things do kind of come together before the episode is out. But those exorcism sequences are creepy.
Yeah, they're...
There's a young boy involved, and...
I will say this. They're movie quality.
Yeah.
I have not seen we've seen some exorcisms on, like, Supernatural, and a few other places. I feel like this is top-notch.
It is, yeah. It was unnerving and had some of the same qualities of the original movie where beyond just the, oh, this is just scary and stuff like that, there's kind of this genuine sense of how, what a sort of terrifying idea a possession is.
Yeah.
And then, as you know, the course of the episode goes along, you know, we see more of Gina Davis. There's some investigation being done by this priest. There's an interesting conversation with another blind priest.
Yeah.
When he goes off to do... where is he going? He's trying to get in touch with... He's trying to find that,
the guy from his... Basically, the guy from his vision.
The guy from his visions, yes. Who, you know... There is a younger and older priest, like the original movie. It's all echoes of it,
yeah.
But it's the dynamics are pretty different, though.
And there's a very good twist to the ending.
Yes.
We're not going to say.
Yeah, I don't want to say what that is. And there's some, you know, it just, I felt like by the end of the episode that it had really come together. But even just within the first 10 minutes, I was like, well, that's off to a really good start.
Yeah.
I kind of kept thinking, well, they're probably going to drop the ball somewhere in there, but instead they kept the quality up throughout.
And I feel like, did you watch the previews of the coming? Basically, they showed previews from this season, which I
really
do in all pilots. I like the ideas that they're seeding, sort of like the larger picture.
Yeah.
I feel like it does kind of fit into sort of like a supernatural type thing, but they're definitely keeping it sort of more grounded Exorcist style.
Right, right. You're not going to see like tons and tons of magic and stuff all the time. It is not one of those shows, you know, it is more of a, you know, kind of dark suspense drama type show and not a supernatural show.
Correct.
I
think it's probably the best horror on television at the moment.
I haven't seen the new season of American Horror Story, but it seems
that one's really good, too.
It does seem like it's so people are a little divided on it, but, like, I guess we're probably living in a good time when it's like, you know, you have strong contenders for good horror TV, which is pretty rare, honestly. There's not usually a lot to go on there, except sort of genre adventure shows like Supernatural and Buffy
which
and whatnot.
Are horror-ish, but not doesn't quite live
They're
up
more
to
adventure them. Than horror,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, they are.
Anyway, yeah, definitely worth a look. Yes. I would say easily, and you know, you don't want to like accidentally trip on like such a great movie as Exorcist. Literally, probably one of the best horror movies ever made.
No, I remember them talking about this and seeing the preview, and I'm like, why are they making this? What was the point?
And I think it sort of goes to if you look at shows that have been expanded upon that expand on other ideas, like not all of these have I seen, but I've seen parts of. Whether it's like Fargo or Hannibal and stuff like that, where they take things that are fairly singular stories and they find these other intersections with them and other ways to expand
on
them.
To find a way to sort of
that
make it work.
It is not as crazy as it might seem.
No, it's not.
Fox has another movie to TV show, which is another one of these, why are you doing this?
Okay.
Lethal Weapon. Which, we're all children of the 80s in one way or the other, and we all love Lethal Weapon.
So Riggs and Murtaugh are our surrogate grumpy cop dads.
Yep.
Yeah.
And
I think we saw the sizzle reel of...
I saw the trailer, and I thought, this looks really terrible.
It does.
And then I watched it because I have a TV podcast, and I was like, well, I'm at least going to watch the first episode.
Yeah.
I kind of liked it.
And I hadn't watched it because I had written it off. And when you said that, I'm like... Okay, I should give this a shot just to see. So I found it on demand through my cable company the other night, and I too really liked
it's a good take on. I mean, here's the thing: this is not going to be as good as Lethal Weapon the movie.
No,
it is definitely,
which is, by the way, about as quintessential a buddy cop movie as is ever gonna be made.
But in sort of reimagining it for TV and sort of modern TV. They do a good job with it. So, Clayne Crawford plays Martin Riggs, and he is playing him. He is not the California beach bum guy that kind of Riggs was.
No, he's a Texas
guy who transferred to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So they're tweaking the story. It's
a
not
little
just
bit.
The lost adventures of it. It's a little bit of a slight reimagining of it.
It opens with sort of Riggs's backstory.
Yeah, it opens with his backstory. So Riggs, Clayne Crawford, by the way, was on...
Killing?
No, Rectify.
Rectify.
And he's fantastic in it, so that guy's got a lot of range.
And he shows it.
He's fantastic here. And Damon Wayans plays Murtaugh, who is a slightly younger Murtaugh, actually.
Slightly.
He's just had open heart surgery, so he wears this little heart monitor watch. And he's feeling his age a little bit. He does not want to be partnered with some cowboy cop, and he actually says that. And there's a sort of the running thing between the first hour is that Riggs is like, "Hey, I understand. You know, you're ready to go be behind a desk or whatever." And it's less of the.
And Murtaugh kind of takes offense to that.
He does. It's basically the thing that Murtaugh has in this one is very much about sort of. It's not about him being partnered with a killer like he was in the first one.
Uh-huh.
It's more of a sort of a whether or not he wants to be out on the street being sort of the bad boy cop again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the conflict that he goes in with. Whereas Riggs has a death wish.
He does.
But
straight up.
They have a great – the reason he doesn't kill himself is not because of the job. it's because his wife would be disappointed in him. He can't do it.
A wife at this point.
No, she's dead.
Oh.
She died and she was pregnant. They really stepped that up.
That opening 5 minutes, my wife was like, I've not seen Lethal Weapon, which I will get her to watch
that.
But she was like, oh my God, that is so horrible. I'm like, yeah, and that scene where Riggs finds out in the hospital
is pretty brutal. Yeah,
and he plays it really well.
So he doesn't. He feel like he would like dishonor her memory.
She wouldn't accept.
She'd be
upset with disappointment, so he can't do it. Yeah, and so he has his death wish. He's basically kind of hoping some criminal will kill him.
Okay,
but he puts himself in situations. I thought the bank standoff scene was really good. Him walking into the bank with some pizzas.
Yep. The interesting thing is that in the movies, Riggs is a Vietnam vet, and he's like this trained killer. He's the lethal weapon of the premise. He's the guy who is a martial artist and all this kind of stuff. This guy is. The Lethal Weapon name doesn't belong as much here because his whole thing is that he does in the opening make a shot. Partner says in one of the early on, I was a little worried because his partner's like, he's like, there are three people in the world who can make that shot, and you're not one of them. And I'm like, wow, that is a little on the nose.
Well, I mean, they do say he was part of the SEALs.
Yeah, he is like a trained operative.
Yeah.
But it's not as much of a thing as it was for the Riggs of the show.
Mm-hmm.
They tweaked it just enough. Oh, Kevin Rahm, who's playing the captain.
Yeah,
he was Murtaugh's old partner. So that's kind of an interesting thing. That's they've got they
so they're throwing some new dynamics.
His wife Trish is interesting. I like what they did with her.
She was great.
It is never going to be like a great show.
No, but I thought it had really good moments. It was
the characters gel. That's pretty much key to the Lethal Weapon concept.
The characters gel. The humor is pretty much there. The action is fantastic.
I was gonna say, the action scenes are good.
The car chase is so, it's like movie level good.
Yeah, and they felt like practical effects too.
I see, by the way, that McGee directed this, which he makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
McGee is for all his failings, is a pretty good action director. Mm-hmm. And Shane Black wrote two of the episodes, or at least has credit for two of the episodes.
So they weren't, you know, this is not a throwaway, let's quick cash in and get out.
No,
it looks like they might have put some real effort into.
I wrote the show off and I rescinding that because it was good.
Oh, I see it says actually based on the screenplay written by. So it's actually Shane Black is getting credit because the story is based on his stuff. But he didn't actually directly work on it.
Gotcha.
Okay,
gotcha.
That makes more sense. But yeah, it's surprisingly good.
I might see if I can catch that. That sounds fun.
And Matthew Miller, who's the showrunner, worked on Chuck, for what that's worth.
That makes sense.
Yeah. The other Fox show, which I think was the best pilot I've seen, is Pitch.
Yeah, this was really good.
I did not expect to like this as much as I did. Pitch is a show about the first female pitcher in Major League Baseball.
Yep.
And it is Fox was promoting this in sort of a smart way as inspired by the true life story that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Because it is. It's like, this is probably coming. It's a woman who's the first pitcher in Major Leagues.
I hope so. I really want it to.
And they're dealing with sort of she is a rookie who's come up out of the minors. And yet at the same time, she's being treated like a star because she's the first woman pitcher. So there's this huge publicity campaign around her. Yeah, her agent, Allie Larder, who is like a shark, is basically wanting her to be treated like kind of prima donna.
Yep.
Mike Paul Gosselaar, by the way, who I would never have thought capable of this, plays like the captain of the team and the catcher, and he's like
When I was talking to you about this, you said, well, do you like, you love the major league? And I was like, yeah. He feels
he's
very
got Tom
much like
Berringer.
Tom Berringer to him. He's playing catcher. He's sort of he's the guru in a lot of ways.
And they sort of flashback throughout, and I like the technique they use to flashback to her dad. His son, he was a minor leaguer who never made it.
Yep.
And his son doesn't want to play baseball, but his young daughter picks up the ball and has an arm.
Yeah.
And so he sort of trains her to be a pitcher and
he becomes her reason for being a player.
Yeah.
And it's interesting some directions that they take that.
Yeah. But I'm not a baseball fan and I'm not always a sports movie type guy. But this reminded me of kind of what I liked about Friday Night Lights, where it's not about the sports, it's about the character stuff. It looks amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they must have MLB's cooperation, because it looks fantastic.
Well, they actually say they're the Padres, so
has
to be...
That's right. She is actually the first pitcher
of
the Padres.
They have some of the announcers from Fox Sports involved.
It feels like something that has MLB cooperation.
They do the Fox Sports logo spinning through, like, when they do the actual baseball scenes. They've got the ticker at the bottom.
Yeah.
So they grounded it.
They really grounded it. I actually love the owner of the team. And I always forget his name. He's always like this character actor.
It's Bob Balaban.
Yeah, Bob Balaban.
From you'd know him from Seinfeld, among other things. But yeah, he's really great. And the guy playing the coach, or not the coach, the manager.
Yes,
is the dad from Wonder Years.
Yep,
and he's fantastic.
I haven't seen
Dan Loria
ages, but he was talented on that show. Just through from what I remember of that show,
really good.
I think this is probably one of the best pilots.
I mean, I haven't seen Exorcist yet, but otherwise, this is my favorite pilot.
Is it? Okay.
I don't know going forward what the show's going to look like.
It'll be interesting, because I don't know how far they can carry the ideas, but I'm very much willing to see where it goes.
The interesting thing is, this pilot was written by Dan Fogelman.
Right.
Who is the guy who, among other things, he did the movie Crazy Stupid Love.
Mm-hmm.
But he also did, he wrote Cars, he wrote Bolt. He's got a little of that sort of...
Seems diverse.
Yeah. Well, he definitely does sort of, I mean, you could argue for sappy.
Right.
Yeah. And some people find it a little, may find this a little melodramatic. If you find it melodramatic, I don't recommend his other pilot, which is also one of my favorite pilots of this year.
I was going to say, this might actually edge out Pitch just a little bit for me.
I thought it was great. I think Pitch is a stronger pilot, but This Is Us is really, really good. This Is Us is on NBC. It tells the story of a group of people who were born on the same day. So it goes through a married couple, Rebecca and Jack, who are expecting triplets. Kevin, who's a television actor who is getting bored of his lifestyle, who works on a show that's called The Manny,
yep.
which mostly is him being having his shirt off. And it's very much in that Big Bang Theory style.
Yep.
And then a woman who's an overweight woman who's sort of dealing with wanting to lose the weight and meeting a guy at that meeting. And then a black man who's been very successful, has like the very successful life, played by Sterling K. Brown from
Supernatural.
Well, and also from People vs. O.J. Simpson.
Right.
And it is about him finding – he was left on the door of a firehouse as a baby. And this is on his birthday. He finds his biological father and sort of goes to confront him. And it's all these stories, and they do weave together. I don't want to give away how they weave together, but – but they all will weave together, and it's really, really good. It's really good character stuff. If you liked like Parenthood
mm-hmm.
and that kind of stuff,
I mean, in the sort of vein of Parenthood, they got great actors for this.
Oh yeah,
Milo Ventimiglia.
There's the thing. I don't think they got great actors. They got actors who I don't usually think of as good who really raised their game. Like Milo Ventimiglia, he was okay in Heroes, but I think him was sort of B level at best.
I like him though. He's got charisma.
If I'm not mistaken, I think he was on an episode or he's on Gotham.
Okay.
And that seems like, Heroes, that seems like his niche. He seems like he's not going to be like a great actor, but well,
and
the
his
material
wife,
elevated him.
And his wife is Mandy Moore, who I like Mandy Moore. She's fine. She was fun in like Entourage Season 2 when she was playing herself, but she's not a great actress. And the guy playing Kevin, the actor, is Justin Hartley, who played Green Arrow on Smallville. These are all B-level actors.
I had completely forgotten that he had played Green Arrow until you mentioned it the other day, and I was like, holy shit.
Honestly, other than Sterling K. Brown, these are B-level actors. Or Chrissy Metz, who plays Kate, I don't know at all. But they're all at their best here.
They are. I love the sort of relationships and the him finding his biological father was probably my favorite story out of this one. Because I feel like the way they play it isn't what you normally expect.
Yeah.
And I think I was just... I mean, you could call the show sappy. I don't think it... For me, it never turned sappy. It was very sentimental and sort of all about sort of the real relationships. So I'm excited to see the second episode.
Yeah, I don't... Again, this is kind of like Pitch. I don't know where it goes forward. I don't know if I stick with it, but it's a really strong pilot, and I'm curious to see what the second episode looks like.
I need to
go
back and watch Bolt. I have never seen Bolt.
Yeah, I liked Bolt. It's not like Pixar great, but it's great. It's good. Finally, there's an ABC show, and this is... Just like This Is Us... Just like Lethal Weapon, I thought I was going to hate this or not bother watching it.
Yeah.
Because it looks like the most premise-y of premise pilots. It's Minnie Driver playing the mom of a son who's got severe cerebral palsy.
I think that's right.
He's in a wheelchair. He's nonverbal. His mind is 100% clear, but he has to speak by using a laser pointer to point to letters and words.
Right.
And she is basically moving the whole family around to try and accommodate this kid. She's going to different schools.
They've been to like 13 different schools.
So she's found a new school that they want to go to. She's moved the family again because the kid's going to have a counselor as like his full-time voice.
Yes.
And the conflicts in this is that the woman he gets to do the voice is sort of this chipper, upbeat woman who he just hates and does not want to be represented. She's not cool enough for him.
Yeah.
And his brother is basically tired of keep moving around and thinks his mom is basically not paying any attention to him.
Right.
And the dad is very much a sort of, let your mom be crazy. We don't want to deal with her. It's like Malcolm in the Middle is what it is.
Yeah,
and that's what I realized when I watched it. You compared it to that.
Yeah.
It's the crazy mom, but she actually does love her kids and is fiercely protective of them.
I thought it would go in directions I didn't want it to go.
Yeah.
Like,
I thought
make
it was gonna be
fun of certain things
yes.
that shouldn't be made fun of. And it never does that. It never plays them as like outright jokes or anything like that.
No,
I think the show has a lot of heart to it, and I think that's what saves it.
It's of a piece with Modern Family and Black-ish.
Yeah,
And it's really good. And the kid in the wheelchair is fantastic.
He's great.
He's really funny.
The guy
Cedric Yarbrough, plays a character who will become a big part of the show, is really fun and stands up to Minnie Driver. Minnie Driver is always great. Like the last thing she was on was About a Boy, And I thought that was not really serving her very well, but she was good in it.
Well, and I know this one's been getting good reviews from people, and I know viewership has been good. So.
I expected to hate this, and I really liked it. And my daughter who watched it with me loved it.
This season seems to be a lesson in expectations.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the fall season has been disappointing for the last 3 years, at least.
I think this has been, so far, been a great fall season, lineup.
Someone woke the networks up. I don't know what happened, but finally they're producing shows I want to watch. They got woke.
Because, Randy, I know you don't watch a lot of network television.
I don't. I was watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and that might be it. That might be the only thing I watch on a network. I was watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but I managed to break the cycle.
I tried
watching Ghost Rider. Oh. The guy playing Ghost Rider is great. Ghost Rider looks good. I don't care about S.H.I.E.L.D. at all. I can't do it. So I'm out.
Ghost Rider for like crap.
Man, that's end of an era.
I think I'm the last one, right? I'm the last holdout. Yeah. No one on the Rogue staff is watching.
As the true last holdout, in the sense that I never started.
You watched the first episode.
That doesn't even count.
Counts.
I got my feet wet, and then immediately bailed. That makes me the harshest of them all.
Yeah, but you'll go back, like you went back to Gotham.
No, I'm not going back to it.
Why don't you go back to Gotham and get your shine box?
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or Gotham is consistently interesting. I'll always be able to give it that, I think.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is also consistent.
Lee, interesting?
No.
Well, and then we've got a few more coming up that haven't hit yet, NBC's Timeless.
I'm looking forward to Timeless. It's Sean Ryan and Eric Kripke.
And then a few at CW that their sort of new season hasn't hit yet.
Yeah, the CW stuff starts in a couple of weeks. But yeah, we've still got, there's still a couple new shows that I'm looking forward to. It's crazy. This is the busiest fall season I've had in a while.
Stinkers.
Oh, did we talk about Kiefer Sutherland's new show?
Oh, Designated Survivor?
Yeah.
I don't have much to say about it.
Oh, is that why you would?
I feel like Designated Survivor is a not great pilot. It's not terrible, but it is sort of, it's okay.
I read a review, and it basically split it into three sections.
Yeah.
And two of the sections are, one is mediocre, one is outright bad, but Kiefer Sutherland is great in this.
I don't agree that one section is outright bad, because I think
you didn't think the bomb stuff?
No, that's outright bad. The family stuff I don't think is mediocre. I think the family stuff is interesting.
I found it interesting, too. I was referring to the review. But
no, I saw that review, too, and I actually thought that he was being overly harsh on the family stuff, because what I want from this show is for it to be, I want it to be the West Wing in a world where a bombing, where it's sort of heightened terrorist levels.
Like, destroys our government.
Yeah.
And basically we have to sort of rise from the ashes.
But I also want to be like, I want to know, like, what would actually happen? What is I want to see the speculative fiction aspect of what happens when this guy who was the Housing and Urban Development Secretary, he's not a politician, becomes the president, but he's been a smart guy all this time.
Yeah.
And how does he deal with the machinery of politics? How does his family deal with the transition? How does he be a president that's sort of a wartime president when you get thrust? Because nobody gets elected to be a wartime president. That is a rare thing.
Yeah.
It occurs to me, what's her name on Battlestar Galactica? Rosalind was she was Secretary of Education and also became that one was probably a little bit less steeped in the real world slightly because of the Cylons.
But that's kind of what I want to see is that kind of thing of like, when you're thrust into that position of power, what happens to you? And I don't know if that's where they're going. I want to watch the second episode.
Yeah. I would bail, for sure.
I want to watch the second episode.
I'm watching it out of love for Kiefer Sutherland.
But I'm going to guess this one does not make my regular rotation. We'll see.
We'll see.
Okay. That's it for us this week. We'll be back next week. And until that time,
Yo-Jo!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.